Listen to the voices of our world.
We don't want to go back to the days of Klan terror.
The whole idea of human rights derives from the idea that we're all created by the same God.
Somehow this situation can and will be changed.
Welcome to Voices of Our World, a presentation of this station and Mary Knoll. I'm Eileen Bott. For most of us, it is our profound hope that the darkest days of racial hatred and violence in the United States are well behind us. That hope is probably grounded in our recollections of black and white news footage that flooded our senses in the 60s, black demonstrators thrown by the water pressure jetting from a fire hose or reeling from the velocity of a nightstick. Those flashbacks are Memphis or Birmingham. They're thankfully over, and you bet they're black and white. But before we congratulate our more civilized selves, recent images come to mind, like that 1998 Labor Day parade float in Queens, New York, on which a group of white firefighters wore blackface and reveled in the notorious dragging death of a black man in Texas, James Byrd. Racial mistrust is not ancient history. It's just learned to tiptoe. Today you'll hear from Signe Waller, a survivor of the 1979 Ku Klux Klan Greensboro Massacre. We'll also hear from Roger Gottlieb, editor of Liberating Faith, and from the man who inspired the progress we have made, Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. You're thinking, this isn't happening. You're the cameraman for a local TV station in North Carolina, and this was supposed to be just another assignment covering some dumb demonstration. But suddenly, those are bullets whizzing through the air. People in your viewfinder are falling to the ground. This is real. Do you steady the camera and try to keep filming? Or do you drop the darn thing and run? We've experienced that hard-pounding point of view before. We felt it when Ruby shot Oswald. Or when a news cameraman tried to keep filming as members of Jim Jones' People's Temple in Guyana shot and killed Congressman Ryan and the others in his entourage. The camera stopped shaking, but kept recording when the cameraman fell dead. You might not remember quite as vividly the incident known as the Greensboro Massacre. It took place November 3, 1979, when members of the Ku Klux Klan and American Nazis shot and killed five people in front of television cameras. The tragedy got buried quickly because it was the very next day that militant Iranian students stormed the American embassy in Tehran and took our hostages. But while you and I may have trouble recalling those on-camera murders, Signe Waller doesn't. Her husband, Dr. James Michael Waller, was one of the five killed that day. After 15 people in all had been shot, the Klan and Nazi shooters piled back in their cars and sped away without any police intervention. Now you might think that since these men were all clearly identifiable on film, that they might have served some significant jail time by now. But that never happened. You see, the victims were members of the Communist Workers' Party. Two all-white juries acquitted the murderers because the jury's aversion to the label communist ran deeper than its aversion to the label Nazi or Klan. Dr. Waller's widow, Signe, has written a memoir, Love and Revolution, on the events before, during, and after. Kathy Golden speaks by phone with Signe Waller.
We are speaking about Love and Revolution, a political memoir. I saw a film of what took place in Greensboro in 79, and I was astounded. Take us back leading up to November. How did this march or rally happen?
In the context of the times, it wasn't all that unusual. The murders happened at an anti-Klan rally on November 3rd, 1979, that was invaded by a caravan of Klansmen and neo-Nazis who opened fire on a crowd that was assembling in a black housing project in Greensboro. The plan was to march through town and have an educational conference, a labor conference, because we were involved in trade union organizing in the textile mills in the area, and we were also involved in a great deal of anti-racist work in the communities of North Carolina. We were involved in movements against apartheid in South Africa at the time. That was before Nelson Mandela was released and elected president. So we were involved in trade organizing work and anti-racist work in North Carolina, which was a right-to-work state. That means very hostile to trade unions, with a history of racism, Jim Crow laws, and all of that. And at the time, the previous year or so had seen a sort of resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan. we were trying to address that and to say that we don't want to go back to the days of Klan terror. And we also were trying to address people who exploit workers and use racism to keep black and white workers divided. So all of that was part of an educational program, and that's sort of the historical context of this Greensboro massacre when Klan and Nazis violently disrupted this anti-Klan march before it could even get started.
I was surprised that all of this happened as late as November 3rd, 1979, because in a sense, the height of violence in the civil rights movement was sort of well prior to that date. I was surprised that this happened that late in time.
Yes, and you are not alone, because people think to the period of the mid and late 1960s with the assault on the Freedom Riders. So 1979, it seems like, well, we should have resolved that and we had the Civil Rights Act and all of that. But because the white supremacist philosophy is embedded in the structure of the country. So the Greensboro massacre was something that happened in Greensboro, but it may have happened in some other place. And in fact, the really significant part of this is that we're not talking about right-wing groups that are strictly private and are outlawed and have no connection with the power structure. Quite the contrary. There was a paid police informant who led the Klan caravan into the attack, paid by the Greensboro Police Department. We're talking about right-wing groups that are being promoted, subsidized, aided, and abetted by government agencies from the local to the federal level. The FBI was involved, the BATF was involved, that's the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. They had an agent in the Nazis who was an agent provocateur who helped the Nazis to arm and to take part in that armed attack. So you have the local police with a paid informant in the Klan, the BATF with their informant in the Nazis, all in complicity with this right-wing attack. And to me, that was very, very significant that really these right-wing groups with their racism and divisiveness and violence have played a role within the power structure of the United States.
How aware of your plans was the Klan and or the police, et cetera?
Well, they were very aware because we had a legal parade permit. We applied for a permit for the march and the rally, and we obtained that, although only 2 days before the march.
Mm-hmm.
This was a perfectly lawful, peaceful, though militant, but peaceful gathering. We were going to have an educational conference at the end of it, a point of opposition to the Ku Klux Klan and everything they stood for. The police knew where the march was starting from. We didn't know it, but the paid police informant in the Klan also had a copy of this parade permit and also knew where the march was starting out from.
And so on either side, was confrontation ever the goal?
I think that violent confrontation was the goal of the right-wing forces, and I think that confrontation was also the goal of the left-wing forces here. And I try to be critical in my book and look at the things we did and the responsibilities we had and how we may do things differently today and how we should do certain things differently. We were very confrontational. We were not violent, but confrontational in our rhetoric. Not that that was a crime. I mean, we should have been allowed to express, even in strong terms, our opposition to the Ku Klux Klan. However, because of that rhetoric, it was used against us afterward as the reason why the killings happened. We were blamed because we had supposedly provoked ourselves being killed, which is saying that when people take a stand for justice, they're provoking the people who perpetrate injustice.
Yeah, as I said, I saw that film recently, which reminds me, this is before we all had video cameras. Who was shooting that film?
Okay, TV stations. This was an anti-Klan rally that was newsworthy. They always covered the Klan, whatever the Klan did, even if they sneezed, you know, that was in the newspaper. But they were not covering our organizing activities. The fact that black and white citizens were uniting against apartheid, against racism, to build trade unions. We were grassroots kinds of people leading these struggles that were struggles for social justice. And the people who were killed were leaders of the people's movement. That was not being covered by the media. But when we said, we're going to stand up to the Klan, then the TV cameras were there. As we were forming, ready to march out, we were standing around in a circle and we were singing freedom songs. And when the Klan caravan drove in, the cameras were rolling. They photographed a Klansman from the lead car in the caravan hanging out of the window and firing a signal shot. the Klansmen and Nazis jumping out of their vehicles, shooting people down. They show Cesar Cosse, one of the leaders who was killed, with a Klansman running down the street with a pistol in each hand, shooting him down point blank, and all Cesar had in his hand was a stick to try to ward off the Klan. And the TV stations from four different places covering that event. Of course, they didn't know what event they were covering, but they were covering an anti-Klan rally.
It's a remarkable film, and I was absolutely startled when I saw it. You know?
Yes.
And all of that was shown to the jury in court, correct?
Yes.
And truly, the verdicts came out as they did, probably because of your connection with the American Communist Party.
Okay, well, it was the Communist Workers' Party, is what this organization was called. It really had nothing to do with the Communist Party USA. And there were many different groups, and their politics differed. But I think the values were solid. It was a commitment to democracy, to social equality, to justice, to workers being empowered. Those were the values. And really, that was the threatening thing. We were organizing in textile mills in North Carolina, uniting workers across racial lines. Workers were beginning to ask for a better contract, a living wage, benefits, a decent pension, and all of that was threatening the owners of textile mills, and that was the biggest employer at the time in the city of Greensboro. And I think the only thing about the more elaborated communist politics was that it was something that was used against us.
That's just it. The philosophies were not involved at all or examined. It was the buzzword or the label communist.
Yes.
That really, no one looked beyond the word.
Right.
And the word was used to defeat you guys.
Exactly. You know, and I would like to, if I might, draw an analogy to the word terrorist today. Indeed, I mean, it's not that there's no such thing in the world as terrorism. There is, and what happened at the World Trade Center was horrible and despicable and was done by terrorists. So indeed, there are terrorists and there is terrorism and it should not exist. However, the label now can very easily be used and slapped on people who have nothing to do with terrorism at all, but who are dissenting from U.S. policy. If that label becomes the way you stop all discussion, if you cannot be critical of your country, and if you love your country, you will be critical of it when you see it heading for disaster.
And rightfully, what you've just pointed out has been brought up on the floor of the United Nations. They're trying to make sure that people understand that each case has to be examined as to what is the difference between a terrorist and a freedom fighter.
Right.
Because we could mislabel people that are fighting for independence.
Yes.
Signe, even though it's been more than 20 years, does this ever, you know, replay in your mind in slow-mo?
Yeah, it does. But, you know, I guess I wrote the book because I had to tell the story. And, you know, I've tried to move on in my life. And I've also tried very hard to remain true to the causes that I thought then were worthwhile and I still think are worthwhile. I wouldn't do or say exactly the same things in all cases as I did or said 20 years ago.
Well, none of us would. I really enjoyed the book very much.
Thank you, Kathy.
Signe Waller.
If Dr. King had lived to celebrate his 75th birthday, would he be more impressed with how far we've come or how far we still have to go?
Email us. Go to our website, www.voicesofourworld.org. Just click on Contact Us. Or call us at 877-MARY-KNOLL. That's 877-MARYKNOLL. You're listening to Voices of Our World.